The Family Care and Aging Committee is called to order. We have a quorum. I want to welcome everybody back. I'm just reacquainting myself with my committee. Hello, we have special guest Senator Dibble who wants to sit in on our welcome to our committee. We've changed. We are now more than the family or the Aging and Long-Term Care Committee. We are now the Family Care and Aging Committee. So we will be listening and discussing a lot more issues that have to do from birth to elder care in this committee, and I look forward to it. Today, we have so many special guests that have been working hard all in the off session on our elder care bills, and I would like to welcome Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of Department of Health, to give us a summary on what the working groups did over the interim and where you're at and what we can look forward to going forward. So thank you so much for coming, Commissioner Malcolm.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Senators. Good morning. It's truly an honor to be back before you this morning to continue this important work that I know you care about, as do we and all of the stakeholders in Minnesota. So I think Madam Chair invited us to give you a report primarily on the work that we've been doing in the interim to try to keep the conversation moving forward on how do we, in terms of improvements to our state statutes that govern the regulation of the long-term care continuum, if you will, when it comes to protecting elder health. But we've actually been thinking quite a bit beyond kind of regulation as well. What are the kind of things we can be doing in collaboration across the industry, because we don't believe this is only a matter of regulatory enforcement, nor is it only a matter of what happens in care facilities, but it's a matter of really changing the culture and embracing a vision in our state that touches every community to better protect and improve the health of elders and vulnerable adults. Before getting into the work group summaries, I just would like to give you a very quick update on the improvements that we've made on the complaint investigation end of this process, which is kind of where this conversation started. I think we, all of us in the state, got an important wake-up call to this broader issue of elder and vulnerable adult abuse, kind of through the lens of what was happening in the complaint system and what wasn't going very well. So I want to give you a quick update. And before I do that, though, I'd really like to acknowledge a couple of folks who worked extremely hard in 2018 and continue to, starting with my friend and deputy commissioner of the health department, Dan Pollack, who's here. Dan played a tremendously important role last year in really operationalizing the agreement that we had with the Department of Human Services. Yesterday was Dan's last day at the Department of Health, and today is his first day at the Department of Human Services. So I'm delighted that we will continue to work together on these policy issues and beyond, but I just want to acknowledge Dan's work last year. We worked with a ton of wonderful folks at DHS in the Continuous Improvement Office and the Office of the Inspector General. We are going to continue to work with DHS to figure out how we can best take the learnings from what we've done together and to think about regulatory collaboration across our two agencies, which I know Senator Abler has been a strong champion of us doing. And I want to thank DHS colleagues as well. And someone I'd like to introduce you to, Lindsay Krueger, who's here. Just wave, Lindsay. Lindsay has been our acting director of the Office of Health Facility Complaints, and she, so many people, including Gil Acevedo, whom you know, worked really hard to kind of untangle what had gone wrong in our operational enforcement of these, complicated and sometimes hard to untangle rules and regulations between the state and the feds. But Lindsay has just done an incredibly important job moving us forward, and I just wanted to publicly acknowledge and thank her for that work. So, real quickly, again, I just want to take a few minutes to do this update report and then get into the work groups. As you well know, you know well the data that brings us here. This is a very significant public health issue in our state. We have about a third of our population over 85 that is under the care of a health facility or home care provider, which means that they are vulnerable adults under Minnesota law. We've got 36,000 people living in 2,600 long-term care facilities, and an additional 90,000 people. Actually, there is some overlap in these numbers. 90,000 people receiving home-based care, including some of the care in facilities that they consider home. The Office of Health Facility Complaints received over 22,500 allegation reports in 2018, which was an average of over 430 each week. And the trajectory and the rise in the volume of allegation reports is part of what created the operational concerns that you so rightly have been focused on. March 1st of last year, I'm sure you remember it as well as I do, the Office of the Legislative Auditor issued a report that was an extremely helpful, I think, diagnostic of what had gone wrong, what were the challenges, and how did they come about in the Office of Health Facility Complaints. And they detailed, I'm not going to go bullet point by bullet point here because you've heard all of this before, but in all there were 23 recommendations that the Legislative Auditor issued for a combination of for OHFC and for the legislature in terms of plugging some of the regulatory gaps that we think are at the root cause of some of what we're seeing out in the communities. You know these data too. We had over a 2,300 case backlog in 2017 at the beginning of the year of allegation reports that had not been reviewed, or we weren't sure if they had been reviewed. It was a literal stack of paper sitting in OHFC. That 2,300 triage backlog, as we refer to it, was cleared by the end of February, again, with the incredible help of DHS. The open investigation cases, there were over 800 of those that had not been completed in terms of the investigation. That backlog was cleared in August and just represented a tremendous amount of work. Also want to acknowledge a really important development last year. Governor Dayton had asked at the very end of last year for a group of consumer organizations to come together to bring forward some really important recommendations for change from the consumer's perspective, which I think was a very important addition to the policy debate to really hear directly from consumer groups who have continued to be really engaged in the discussions I'm going to talk to you about this morning. So we had all of that kind of input from the legislative auditor and the consumer groups last year. You spent a lot of time on this issue. Madam Chair spent an extremely significant amount of time working on this issue. So we had a lot of discussion, but in the end, you know, as you well know, the issues around all of this were kind of wrapped up in the end of session budget and so forth, and we didn't get actual policy change out of last year's session, but we learned a tremendous amount and have continued that work, which I'll tell you about. Just currently, so where are we? Having done a lot of important work to improve operations, I'll just give you a little bit of data, and we can certainly dive into this at a future hearing. I'm sure you'd be interested in knowing more about what's kind of underneath the covers of these summary statistics. I mentioned we received 22,500 allegation reports last year. About 1,400 of those were assigned for on-site investigation. It's really important to understand what happens when the allegation reports come in. There's a very important front-end process that looks at whether what is the allegation. Is it our jurisdiction? Does it meet the state standards or definitions of the things that we're supposed to investigate on-site, either under federal or state definitions? So it's a relatively small percentage of the received allegation reports that get on-site investigations. However, I will say it's very, very important that we take and use all of the data that comes in through that process, not just the investigated complaints, but those allegations that come in that all have important data in terms of the experience of people from a service quality, a care quality perspective. So I'll comment on that again, and you'll hear that from the work group reports, how important it is that we not only look at this investigated complaint set of data, but that we look at all of the data that's in the system. So of the 1,400 cases that were assigned in 2018, about 780 were completed in 18 that were received in 18. But when you can kind of combine the backlog from prior years with 2018, The office investigated that total of investigated and closed a total of 1,441 investigations last year. About 236 of those on-site investigations resulted in a substantiated finding under statutory guidelines. 127 were inconclusive, and 416 were not substantiated. Now, that too, I think, deserves some real clarity, and we should probably spend some more time on that in another hearing. What do those terms mean, substantiated, not substantiated, inconclusive? All of the data that comes in each of those buckets are important to us to understand and to trend. We have very much improved workflows and management practices in the office, but I have said to you before, and I'll keep saying, you know, the progress that we've made is very, very real, and it is not complete, and it is not what I would call hardwired. We're still, you know, still changing workflows. We're still training people. We're still hiring people into new roles and new jobs as the workflows have been improved. So the system continues to need the vigilant oversight that you have strongly demanded that we provide, and continues to be a very high priority for me personally and for the department to make sure we finish this job and learn from the hard learnings that we've all had about how to improve not only the processes in this office, but how we approach our health regulation functions in general. We have made some progress on making this not just a paper-based system. We do have a paperless document management system now, but it is not a full and robust case management system, which you'll hear from us about this session. Managers are able to use these electronic interim tools, though, to much more efficiently manage the process and to understand, you know, kind of where we are, where backlogs are growing, how to kind of move staffing around to deal with highest priority areas. And as I mentioned, we've redesigned the workflows and the jobs to go along with new workflows and new tools. Just a tremendous amount of change that the folks in this office have been subject to. We have been working to improve the public reports of investigation findings. We've done some, you know, really important, I think, thinking about how to best streamline the work within our health regulation division. So we've got people with the best skills doing the right kind of work and similar kind of work across different kind of facilities. And that, I think, is going to both improve our quality and our efficiency. We're putting much more emphasis into auditing. You have asked, many of you in this committee have asked, well, okay, you've gotten through the backlog, but how do we know you're doing a quality job? It's very important that we audit at every step of this process to make sure that we are having consistency and we are having quality in how things are judged at the front end as to whether they merit on-site investigation or not, and then what happens in that process. So I don't think we're completely there in terms of auditing as much as we want to, but we've designed auditing systems and are building that into our process going forward. All the appeals are now done not in the Office of Health Facility Complaints, but in the legal unit, so that we've got kind of that independence of review and appropriate eyes on appeals in the process. We've standardized a lot. So the workflows and the folks at every step of this process are now using documented work processes and are trained consistently so that the work is more predictable and more common across different people who are doing it. The work that we've done with DHS has helped us get much better at the front end at more quickly sorting out jurisdictional issues of what should be dealt with by MDH versus DHS or the counties or law enforcement, and we're continuing that process. We've tried to put an emphasis on more timely and better, more thorough and more, I will say, human communication with complainants, residents in facilities and families to try to help our staff. And believe me, I've been so impressed that these staff who've gone through all this change really are motivated to want to do the right thing for Minnesota families. They've been hampered by poor systems and just lots and lots of needs to improve the way they do their work so that they can do the quality job they want to do. But we've tried to now write our letters differently, to make sure people have phone numbers, to make sure they know how they can appeal decisions, and then they can talk to people about the findings. And we welcome that feedback. It's very important to us. We have since last spring been publicly reporting kind of on the volume of what we're seeing and what we're doing with the volume that we see. We publish a dashboard every week on our website, which we think is an important public accountability tool. And we continue to get good feedback from policymakers, from families, from the industry on how to make this dashboard even more useful for everyone's purposes. So where we're going now is we continue, as I said, to have to really keep on making sure that we're documenting these improved workflows, that we're auditing them, that we're continuously improving them, that we're getting the feedback from the frontline staff about whether the new processes are working as they're intended, and that we're really, you know, spending the time on the training up front that I quite honestly think we had not been giving adequate attention to in the past. We continue to meet to work to meet the Office of Legislative Auditor's recommendations. Some of those, with respect to a new case management system and more analytics, do require additional legislative support in the form of financial resources and or policy recommendations. As I mentioned, we're trying to really take these lessons and apply them not just to the Office of Health Facility Complaints, but to the other regulatory functions that touch not only long-term care, but acute care as well, and learning some of what we've learned about health facility regulation across the continuum, not to see them as necessarily so siloed. As I mentioned, I'm very enthused about continuing the conversation with DHS and Commissioner Lurie about how we might organize our regulatory efforts and continue to collaborate to use best practices and share resources where that makes sense, given that there is we've learned a lot in the last year about the similarities and differences in components of our work. So we're doing a lot more, as I say, to try to use information for true public health purposes, to say there's a tremendous amount of information flowing through the system. The regulatory enforcement is a very important piece of the process, but the data that we gather through the experiences of consumers, through the self-reports of providers, are important to analyze in total, not just, you know, checking the box at the end of the investigation process as to was this something that met the definitions of abuse and neglect under either federal or state law and processes. Was it substantiated by a preponderance of the evidence, or was it not? That's not the end of the process, that we need to make full use of all of this information and begin to share it more proactively. One of the things we're working at is not just to wait to get data practices requests, but to figure out, and here's something we may well need to come back to you on from a policy standpoint, how can we create public use files of our data so that folks can be appropriately on a de-identified aggregated basis, not waiting, you know, for us to issue reports once every year or so, and not having to make data practices requests all the time, but have access to this data for research purposes and for their own investigations. That's easier said than done, I'm learning, but philosophically, that's where we want to go, is to be much more transparent with the information and much more oriented to having everybody working together to prevent these incidents in the first place, and learning what we can, as we do in other elements of health improvement and health regulation. So that's a good segue into the main topic for your meeting this morning, which is these policy efforts. So if we were to successfully implement every one of the legislative auditor's recommendations in terms of MDH improving its processes, which we fully own and intend to do, we still wouldn't have made an adequate response to this issue for the people of Minnesota. The legislative office auditor pointed out a number of areas in which our state law seemed to have gaps, or at the very least be very, very confusing. The way that regulatory standards of what applies to what are so fragmented and really hard to understand for consumers, certainly, for policymakers, for regulators, and for providers. So what we did after last session was to try to create a space for continued conversation and for continued conversation with all the stakeholders in the same room, as opposed to kind of in our separate corners. And so I just informally, it was a very informal process. This was not chartered by the legislature. It wasn't chartered by the governor. It was just, you know, folks kept talking after session, like, what are we going to do to keep moving this forward? So we just informally, I invited folks to come and get organized into six work groups that were looking at assisted living licensure approaches, certification of dementia care units, electronic monitoring in care facilities, consumer rights, prevention strategies to improve quality and safety. And DHS has been and will continue to work on an assisted living report card. But so how might that report card idea feed into these other topics? So we just started meeting in the middle of September. And again, I want to reinforce this was very unofficial, wasn't professionally facilitated or staffed. It was volunteer time, and so many people spent so many time going to these work group meetings and contributing their ideas and listening to each other and being educated. I mean, last year, you know, I think the conversation was hard to follow because folks kept asserting very different things, you know, about whether we did or didn't have regulatory gaps. And folks would say, well, assisted living isn't regulated at all. That's one of the things in our system that the legislative auditor pointed out. Minnesota's kind of unique in having an assisted living system where the assisted living facility isn't regulated. But folks would also say, you know, from the industry, they'd say, I don't know what you mean. It's not regulated. There's all this home care regulation that applies, and it's just incorrect to say there's no regulation. So it was really valuable, and we spent a lot of hours just listening to each other and getting educated on where did this whole housing with services concept come from? What was the goal? What was the idea? What was it in theory versus how is it working in real life from the perspective of administrators of facilities, regulators, and consumers? So the kind of mutual understanding that was built over these last few months, I think, was really important. And a space for people to ask each other questions and to say, oh, well, I never understood. When you said that, you know, what does that mean? So just the ability to kind of trade perspectives and be working from a more common base of understanding now about the real complexity in Minnesota's kind of regulatory framework, but also kind of what was the intent or the idea behind it, so we can be a little more informed about when we're talking about filling gaps, starting over, you know, using what tools. So with that, I'm just going to give you a really quick overview of the work group that I convened, which was to look at this concept of licensure of assisted living. And I'll just tell you, each of these six work groups has a written report, which we're just kind of packaging up right now, and our intent is to release that to you and to all the stakeholder groups within the next couple of days. All of our meeting materials have been posted on our website, but you'll have this package of reports in writing, but you're going to hear today the conclusions and the recommendations from each of the work group chairs. So in the licensure work group, we agreed that at the very least, we need to pull all of the sections of law that are come in different chapters and under different umbrellas, pull it all into one place so we can see what pieces of state law apply to care that's delivered in assisted living facilities. Instead of saying, well, it's regulated, but it's over there in a chapter you wouldn't think to look at. So pulling it all together in one place just makes common sense. The core idea, though, is to take this housing with services registration system, which is currently what applies to assisted living facilities, which is where the great majority of folks live, not in certified regulated nursing homes, but in assisted living facilities, which is today not a licensure system, but it's a registration system where if you are a housing with services provider, you don't have to get licensed to be a housing with services facility. You have to get registered. So the concept here is to say we need to build on that system and create levels of higher levels of regulation, including licensure, tied to the complexity of the services that are offered in those settings, and the complexity of need of the patients, the type of services that are being offered, and really the degree of consumer control over the service mix that's in that facility. So what we're proposing is kind of a tiered structure or levels of regulation. If a facility is only offering housing, not healthcare services, then maybe this registration approach still makes sense, a light touch regulation. A level one facility might be, but anything beyond just housing needs something more than what we have today, we believe. So level one might be housing that offers supportive services only, but no healthcare services. Level two might be those that offer a level of healthcare services that we currently defined in the home care law as basic healthcare services. A level three would be a facility that offers healthcare services that are defined as comprehensive services under the home care law. But again, not just cross-referring to another chapter, but pulling this all into one chapter. A level four and or a separate certification process for dementia care units or memory care. So, and there was vigorous debate, and we didn't reach perfect agreement on how many levels should there be, and is it better to have more levels or fewer levels? You'll hear different perspectives from folks on that. But the concept of moving beyond simply a registration system, but correlating that with what's the complexity of the services offered, is that was, a pretty big move forward and a really important kind of coming together of the perspectives of consumers, advocates, researchers, policy administrators through MDH, DHS, and the ombudsman, and the industry. So that's kind of the nub of it. The law that we are going to, and we MDH, have been working on pulling together language that incorporates the ideas from all of these work groups, and look forward to presenting that to the governor's office and to all of you very soon. So talked with Madam Chair about this. We will have some legislation to offer you that kind of incorporates all of these components. It's still being drafted. This assisted living licensure or assisted living statute will include physical plant requirements. One thing, and you'll hear this, I think, from some of the other work groups, we really feel the need to have more rigor around the upfront assessment of clients when people are evaluated and admitted or not admitted based upon their care needs. That whole process needs more documentation and more standardization, that client assessments be done in a more kind of informed way. More specificity and standard language in marketing materials, more disclosures to prospective clients and residents. We need to define some of these terms in law that get thrown around but are defined differently today. So what is supportive services? What are healthcare services? Which healthcare services? So what is an arranged home care provider? So we've got these important terms in law that or referred to that aren't defined. The point, though, the goal is to create more transparency for consumers, more rigor in the upfront selection process. This is a market that is intentionally trying to create choices and allow choices, but we think that better informed choices will lead to much better outcomes. Also an area that needs definition in statute, we believe, and there's agreement that there needs to be more process requirements around when services are terminated or leases are terminated for folks living in assisted living. The nursing home standards are much, much, much more rigorous in terms of when people can be discharged and what kind of care transition planning needs to be offered to them before they can be discharged. We're not proposing the same necessarily standards for assisted living, but more definition and requirements around the process by which people are required to make a change. And very importantly, the housing with services split has created a regime in which it can be very hard to figure out who's accountable for what between the facility operator and owner versus the home care contracted agency versus perhaps an independent home care provider that a consumer may bring in to augment the services. So figuring all that out and saying, what happens within this umbrella of an assisted living facility, there needs to be clearer accountability standards that somebody needs to be accountable for what's being offered in the facility, even if there's a kind of a contracting arrangement. There are many details to be worked out here in terms of how that's going to be applied, who's the license holder, and how do you enforce accountability when there is intended to be some level of choice for both the consumer and the provider in terms of what realistically can be offered. But that's sort of the concept, and that's where we need to go next in terms of getting some language in front of you so that we can begin working with all the stakeholders on fleshing out these concepts. So that's the really, really high-level summary of what the idea is here, that we would end up with an assisted living licensure system, but with kind of gradated requirements depending upon the complexity of the services. The goal is not to turn everything into a nursing home. On the other hand, we also want to point out that there remains a critical need for nursing home level care in our state, and we really need to keep our eye on making sure that we're not losing too much critical capacity in the nursing home industry, just given what we're seeing with the population, the aging of the population, the intensifying needs of people who are living longer with more complex conditions. So we really need to take a continuum approach to this and design a regulatory processes that are mindful of the whole continuum and protect the continuum, not try to collapse it all into one thing, but to have a regulatory scheme that sort of is mindful of the system as a whole and how people move between parts of the system. That's going to be a multi-year process, I can pretty much promise you, to kind of figure out how do we modernize our regulatory approach to the whole continuum of care, not just to this one area that we've been focused on around assisted living, because that's such a fast-growing part of the industry, but really applying some of these concepts, and I think you'll hear that from the other work groups, that what we're talking about dementia care standards or electronic monitoring doesn't just apply within a nursing home or an assisted living facility. Some of these consumer protections we believe should be available to people regardless of what facility they happen to be in, but you have to figure out the level of regulatory requirement enforcement authority depending upon where in that continuum folks are. So, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer questions right now or to turn it over to the next work group, whatever would work best for you.
Thank you so much, Commissioner Malcolm. And thank you for all of the informal work that you did in the off session, but it was really helpful, and I've heard from a lot of the stakeholders and the consumers that it was really helpful. And I want to thank Larissa on my committee. She's my former CA, and now I have Tricia Elate, but Larissa Fisher went to all of those committees, too, and brought back all of the information. So thank you for organizing those. I think we'll ask you the questions now, just because I know you have someplace else you need to go. So I'm going to start with Senator Frentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good to be back. And speaking of good to be back, thank you, Commissioner, for agreeing to stay on. Appreciate the work that you've done. I also want to give a quick shout-out to Legislative Auditor Report. It's another example of OLA helping agencies in Minnesota get some things right. So thank you for that. I think I see Ms. Randall back there somewhere. My question is, you talk about a common base of understanding, and we're talking about licensing assisted living facilities. As you outline some goals, how much common base of understanding do we have with the facilities at this point, and how much work yet to be done to find peace in the valley on that very important topic? Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Krentz, you're absolutely right to point out that there's a lot of detail yet to be done, but the concept of moving beyond simple registration and moving into a system where there are increasing regulatory standards for each kind of level of complexity, there is general agreement with that notion. So as we start, looking at language, that I know we're going to get lots of feedback from all stakeholders, but that we pretty thoroughly vetted the idea of just the basic kind of notion of a graduated level of standards depending upon whether something is offering only supportive services, basic healthcare services, comprehensive healthcare services. And there is widespread agreement that we need much more around dementia care standards. So I think you'll hear from a couple of the other work groups, how much detail they got into on those components of the idea. But I would say, I don't want to speak for for the industry, but and I know it's a big industry with lots of stakeholders, that they were certainly, you know, at the table and in the conversations, and I think while again acknowledging that figuring out things like how are we going to really figure out this, the notion of having a single license holder be responsible for what might be a pretty complex mix of services, that's probably, you know, one of the hardest points to figure out is that, but the idea of, yeah, we really need to make, if we don't end up with a single license holder, we need a heck of a lot more clarity on how you create accountability if it's a multiple license holder situation.
Thank you. Senator Curran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Malcolm, I appreciate you providing us with the update. I was just curious on some of the statistics, and I know we don't want to dive too deeply into it, but in the claims or the complaints that we have, we got, 22,000 complaints. What is it, 1,400 that you actually chose to investigate, and then just 236 are substantiated. So I just would looking for a general breakdown of the substantiated claims on an unlicensed facility versus a licensed facility.
Madam Chair, Senator Curran, that's a great question. I'm sorry I don't have that level of detail in my head right now, but I will find that out and get it back to you. I do think it's really good to dive into these numbers more deeply because, for instance, of the, and you can see this on the dashboard, the number of the largest number of reports that are coming into the system are actually facility self-reports. Mm-hmm. That a pretty small minority of facility self-reports, I think facilities are encouraged because they have penalties if they don't self-report a lot of things within like 24 hours. So the default is kind of report everything and then sort out later, you know, whether that is something, whether the problem got resolved within that 24 hours. So there's a lot in the system that we need to kind of do a better job of breaking down the data so you can see what kinds of reports and what, you know, what type of them tend to result in substantiated findings, which are then, there's some regulatory consequence for. One of the things I failed to mention, but I just want to reinforce, I think one of the most important things we've done is change the triage system so that there are eyes on every complaint within 48 hours. So that instead of, you know, something potentially sitting in a stack that no one looked at, we've now kind of re-engineered the system so that we're trying our level best, and I'm not going to say that we do it perfectly every time, but we're trying to make sure that the things that represent the most significant risk to health or safety are, we get on those right away. And I think, so when you see these numbers of, you know, still how long it takes us on average to close an investigation, that it's good to kind of break down how quickly our investigations closed on the most serious cases, which is now a lot faster than it used to be. So I would love to come back with more detailed breakdown of the data.
Senator Curran.
Madam Chair, we'll just follow up. Thank you, Commissioner Malcolm. And I think that's the point where I'm going to get to, and the continued theme of what you heard from me and what you probably heard from me last year is that I'm not interested in continually doing the same thing over and over and applying just a bigger, shinier hammer to the problem. And so when we talk about the number of complaints and number of self-reports, all I hear when I hear those things is that we've got a level of fear that we've instilled to self-report, and we want those things to get better. But at the same time, all I see is then we're taking more people away from providing care more often during the day to facilitate your agency's needs or Department of Human Services needs in a reporting and a fulfillment of your needs in which are determined. Because the first part of your update today was focused mostly on process improvement relative to the OLA's report. And I asked kind of, well, why now? Everything that was within that report, the OLA is not the expert on your job and your agency. They become experts, and I love the OLA. But why now? Everything that we've talked about was all well within your purview to resolve over the last, you know, variety of years. So I want to make sure that we focus on what are we going to do differently Not that it makes us feel better about you doing your job or expanding the job of reporting and those things that make us feel good, but I want to see examples and specific cases where we've actually improved or resolved an issue we're trying to tackle. So that's what I'm looking for is what are we going to do differently? And I'm not sorry, I don't want to start out the session like this, but that's our key question. What are we going to do differently? And the things that we've talked about today look a lot like what we're just used to and mm-hmm. how we do a better job. Well, your agency should be doing a great job already. Mm-hmm. And so those are the things that I'd be interested in. I'm absolutely committed to working with you on figuring out how we're going to do it differently and actually make a difference in providing care and making sure our seniors have the best available. So thank you.
Thank you. Senator Ralph.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I've been taking notes copiously, and I'm not going to get into the weeds too deep here, but just as an overthought, and I think Senator Coran touched on this, and I'd like to just follow up a little bit. The whole object here is to improve the quality of life for the people who are in the care of these facilities, and I echo Senator Coran in that. What are we going to change? And those changes have to be purpose driven. So I guess what I'd like to do is I've just got a couple of questions that come to mind immediately, and that is we have 236 substantiated complaints out of 22,000. I think that's 0.1%. So that brings up two obvious questions. One, why so many complaints and why so few substantiations? And we don't need to get into detail on that, but I think that's a question we have to ask. The other question I have in that specific area is, what have we done with those 236 substantiated complaints? And I wonder if you could just give us maybe a quick and short summary of what happened to those complaints and what did we do that would lead to an improvement both in the care but also in the procedures so that we don't have as many complaints?
Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair, Senator... And both senators, I couldn't agree with you more that the goal here is not just to get faster at taking regulatory actions, but actually working upstream to improve the quality of care and quality of life for seniors. I couldn't agree more. And I think you'll hear that from some of the work groups. And it's not just a matter of regulation, but the right regulation competently enforced can help. I think with respect to I think it would be really good for all of us if we could continue to work to improve the reporting system itself. I mean, one of the reasons for the uptick in filed reports, as you know, was the development of the MARC system. A lot of these allegation reports used to go through the counties and be resolved at that level. So we've got much more visibility now, I think, which is a good thing as a tool for quality improvement to the experiences of consumers all over the state that are now coming through a more centralized process. But the kinds of the reports that we're getting and why we need to be working with the industry to say what kind of things should be reported, how do you make sure that we can focus the analytic time and the investigatory time on the serious issues, but then how do we also turn it into alerts to facilities. When we're finding substantiated complaints, we ought to be reporting back to the industry to say, hey, you know, we're finding a real uptick in this, that, or the other thing, just like we do with acute care. You know, we issue, you know, kind of health alerts to various things we're seeing. We have our adverse events reporting system. So and I think we can learn from those activities about how to more proactively work with the industry to take a look at these trends and kind of forecast them out and say, how do we, if this is emerging as a common problem, and certainly one of the problems you'll hear from the industry is workforce challenges. The difficult, and that's a real issue, and all of us who have worked with these work groups, all of us kind of raise that as the same concern. We'd like to raise the bar, if you will, and raise the standards for care, and we're just going to have to be mindful of the added challenge that increased regulatory standards will bring when we're already struggling with workforce challenges. Substantiated complaints, and again, you know, I think, and not as I sit here today, I don't have a brilliant recommendation for you on what we should do about this, but I think it's time to look at the VAA itself, the Vulnerable Adults Act, and some of the definitions and some of the standards for how we can adjudicate complaints. I know from consumers' perspective, they are very frustrated by this, you know, kind of this distinction between substantiated, unsubstantiated, and inconclusive, as if unless it's substantiated, their concern is not an important concern. That is not the case. That's one message we've taken to heart at MDH, and I think all of us should be. It's not that things that aren't substantiated aren't important. The standard is a preponderance of evidence that proves that the responsibility for the bad outcome was because of actions taken or not taken by a provider or a facility. It's a pretty hard standard to meet, actually, which, again, doesn't mean something bad didn't happen and that we can't learn from it. But the substantiation with a preponderance of the evidence, similarly unsubstantiated, means there was a preponderance of the evidence that the bad outcome was not caused by the actions of a facility or a provider. So, you know, I'm surprised there's not more in the inconclusive bucket, although that's a fairly large set of the action. I feel like I'm going into a little bit of a rabbit hole here. It'd be better, I think, to come back to you with a more specific drill down on the data of what can we tell you about kind of what kinds of things are in each of those buckets. But that's a very, we're just starting to kind of build the reports and the analytic capacity to look at it that way.
Well, excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just specifically, the substantiated reports, what happens to those facilities? What is the next step, so to speak, when you have a substantiated report?
A whole variety of things can happen. There can be licensure actions taken. There can be fines issued. We can attach, you know, like additional. We can kind of flag a facility to go. Kind of be more closely monitoring a facility that's had repeated numbers of things, but fines are the, you know, kind of the perhaps the most immediate thing that we can do, and we have been issuing more fines in the recent past.
Senator Ralph,
thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me, and the reason I ask this question, we're substantiating abuse in an unregulated situation. We understand we don't have a uniform system of regulation that leads to improvement in the area, and yet we find these substantiated complaints, and it seems to me that we're trying to work against a backdrop that doesn't provide a mechanism for dealing with what is happening that's adverse. That's just something I'd like to comment on, which I think leads to the other issue. And I want to just extend my heartfelt thanks to you and the stakeholders that have been getting together, kind of without a legislative prompteur on it. I am also very concerned about the workforce. I do chair an ad hoc committee, I'm sure, and there's many people in the audience that have contributed to that to try and improve the workforce situation in the whole, primarily the home-based and community-based, but across the healthcare spectrum. So I see in this situation, we have two issues, really. We have the OHFC. And that stands over here, but then the licensure over here and how we deal with that. I guess the question that I have is, we do already have significant regulation of the actual provider, the nurses, the PCAs, whatever you wish to look at. We do actually have a substantial structure and regulatory scheme. How are you approaching taking that and incorporating it into a licensure system in the unregulated area? And as a second question, what have other states done in this area, and have you looked at that?
Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair, Senator, we are looking at models of how other states do it. We are unique in Minnesota that we haven't heretofore had a licensure system for assisted living, But as we've learned, that's been kind of by design to allow this more customizable approach to housing with services. So as we kind of pull the related sections of law together and talk about what characterizes an assisted living facility in these different tiers of service offerings, the home care, the home care standards are what we're going to build off of. So, but kind of figuring out that we can't just kind of artificially separate the providers of care from the facilities in which they're providing the care. Because from the consumer's perspective, you think you're buying a package of services. And oftentimes, the services that are provided to you in the assisted living facility are not services that you can pick and choose. It comes as a package. So we need to, we believe, kind of approach it and regulate it as a package so that, that there's a correlation between, who's being hired by whom to provide the actual professional care services in this facility when the family and the consumers and the providers who are also working with the patient think that that's a more unified system. So it's absolutely, I think you're right. We're not starting from ground zero with no regulatory framework, but figuring out how to pull the home care standards into a licensure approach for the facilities in which the home care is offered is the key.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Ralph. And then Senator Eakin, then we got to quickly move on because we're going over here.
Sure.
Well, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Malcolm, for the very important work that you're doing here. And I applaud you for trying to pull things together. I think your working group has some great ideas as far as getting greater transparency and accountability, and that can be accomplished in a, I think, or can help to be accomplished in a great way through this simplification, streamlining, and pulling together of the whole system. It's awfully complicated. But I was drawn to the same issues that Senator Curran and Ralph were on the statistics and wanting to drill down further into those numbers to really understand what's happening here when we're talking about the substantiated cases of abuse or neglect. And one thing that stood out to me was the 30% were substantiated, significantly increased up from the OLA report findings of 16 to 19% substantiated cases from 2012 to 2016. And again, I'd kind of like to drill down further in that as well. Is that an indication of the increase in abuse and neglect that's occurring out there? Is there a significant increase? And also, obviously, we want to know why and what those substantiated cases are and what can be done about it. But those are some of the things that I'd like to drill down a little further in, as well as, are these cases happening in the nursing homes or in the assisted livings and things of that nature, so that we can really get a handle on what's happening and what we need to do.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator, thank you so much. I'm really enthused about the fact that we're now building the kinds of reporting capability and staff capability to actually take this data and do trend analysis and come back to you with a much better breakdown. This, again, until 9 months ago, was all a paper-based process where even figuring out what percentage of the reports were self-reports from facilities would have taken, an enormous amount of manual time. The fact that we now can pull these statistics and start to sort them is very new capability for us, but it's exactly the right sort of thing that will allow us to bring you back a level of detail and some, if not answers, intelligent theories about what is it that we're seeing and why.
Thank you. I have a lot of questions too here that I've written down on a deeper dive on the data, and are you able to share it with the providers, and what percentage is medication errors or faulty equipment. Do you know, when do you expect your proposal to be ready for the legislature?
The language?
Yeah.
I'm hoping that we can begin to share that more publicly next week.
Okay.
So it's not months away or weeks away, it's more like days away. But I don't want to speak for or put the governor's office in a box, as they're just pulling their review processes together. But we've already talked about the value of sharing the language as early and as broadly as we can. So I think that's consistent with the governor's philosophy about engaging people in the discussion.
Thank you so much, Commissioner Malcolm, for all of the work you've done, and we will continue to work together. Oh, Senator Ralph? I mean, yes. Senator Newton, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question actually more for you, I think, is as we have changed the name of the committee to Family Care and Aging, are we now going to include group homes and home health care within the same purview? And if so, you know, there's a whole lot more of reporting that would have to be included. So if you could give us an understanding of the committee's limits.
Senator Newton, we are continuing to work on that and where we go with it and how much do we really want to take on. But the group homes and the other thing you mentioned, that will be under our purview. Yes, so there will be a lot more reporting that we will have to get reports on. Right, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Malcolm. Carrie Benson, Board of Aging, Department of Human Services, with the Assisted Living Report Card. Oh, do you not want to do it that way? You want to do it a different way?
It's okay, Madam Chair. We've got the slides loaded in a
so we'll do
order,
it the way your slides are.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
All right, so then we've got, then it's Beth McMullen is next up on the slide, the Alzheimer's Association.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth McMullen, and I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for the Alzheimer's Association. I was pleased to serve as the convener of the Dementia Standards Work Group at the request of Commissioner Malcolm last fall. I want to note that I'm speaking on behalf of that work group. So this is representing a work group's the work group's process, not the Alzheimer's Association position necessarily. So Commissioner Malcolm asked us to lead an open discussion on this issue, to seek consensus where we could, and to identify and dig into areas of disagreement to better understand our differences. Participants included a broad group of stakeholders ranging from interested community members, elder law attorneys, agency reps from DHS and MDH, individual long-term care providers and their representatives, and even some direct caregivers. While we did not develop a legislative proposal per se, we did come a long way in identifying areas of consensus and disagreement, as well as recommending a general framework for dementia standards. At our first meeting, we talked about our vision for high-quality care, dementia care across all settings, but decided that with the limited time and resources that we had, that we should focus our discussion on dementia standards in the newly contemplated assisted living license framework, so the work that the commissioner was leading. I want to note that about a third of the housing with services facilities are currently registered as dementia or memory care. So that's about six. At the time we were working on it, it was 625 of the 1,700 housing with services. So this is, you know, a substantial portion of the facilities that will likely be licensed under this new framework. I wanted to show this person-centered focus wheel. Our vision for the work group is outlined in the report, so I won't go into that in detail, but I wanted to share this with you because we referred to it and a number of the pie slices that you see around the edges throughout our work. This is based on the Alzheimer's Association Dementia Care Practice Recommendations, which were just released in 2018, and those recommendations outline what quality care practices should be for dementia care, and it's based on a comprehensive review of current evidence, best practice, and expert opinion, and it was published in the Gerontology Journal in 2018. It's a nice, thick report. If anybody wants to read it, I'm happy to share that with you. So our group came up with three kind of high-level recommendations. The first is that people living with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias should not be required to reside in a dementia care setting. Those people in early stages of dementia may not have special care needs, and we don't want to force people into a particular type of setting. So they should have a choice of where they live. But that for those facilities that are identifying themselves as dementia care specialists or memory care units, that we should have an additional set of requirements that they need to meet so that we're sure that they are the experts that they're saying they are. And finally, the first two are green because there was general agreement on that. The third one is yellow because I think we need to work on some of the specific language, but I think we can get there. And that is that since we know people with dementia will be living in all settings, from home settings through nursing homes, that all assisted living settings should meet minimum dementia training requirements, so that everybody who's working with someone who is living with dementia has that, at least that basic training level. So then, in order to focus our discussion spreader, we broke our work into three general categories, and because I want to make sure that my other colleagues have time to report on theirs, I'm going to kind of skip over training and disclosure. Basically, our training requirements are good. We talked about a few places where we might be able to make them better, and so those are outlined in our report. Actually, one thing I will mention, if I can do this. Yes. We did talk about specifically additional training considerations in dementia care units, and that's the specific for DCU on the slide. We should look at shortening the time frame from the date of hire for a direct care worker until their dementia training is completed. And we also talked about having on-floor supervision by trained competent staff of any staff that have not yet completed that dementia training. So those were some specific training things that we talked about for dementia care units. Again, on disclosure, I think the disclosure that we have for Housing with Services, we talked about it and felt that it was generally good. We talked about a few places where we might be able to tweak it and make it a little bit better. So I want to focus most of my time talking about what is really the new area that we focused on, and that is, what are those minimum standards for dementia care settings? So if you are saying you are a memory care specialist, what do we want to make sure that MDH can regulate and that consumers know is being monitored? First, we said that these standards should not be in conflict with nursing home standards. As Commissioner Malcolm said, our group agreed. We are not trying to create mini nursing homes, but we want to make sure that any dementia practice recommendations line up with what's in nursing homes. So they don't have to be identical because they are serving different populations. Next, we agreed that the staff should have the skills, training, and education to really care for a resident population living with dementia. And our recommendations on that are highlighted in the training section. We agreed also to maybe improve the disclosure a little bit, but that's really important. That was covered in the disclosure section. The other area of agreement was 24-hour awake staff. So in dementia care settings, that it is really important that you have someone who is there, who is monitoring the residents at all times. A number of areas where we got really close, but as you all know, the devil's in the details, and we just didn't have time in the limited four meetings or so that we had to iron everything out. But we generally had agreement around, in a dementia care setting, there should be activity programming, therapeutic programming appropriate for the cognitive level of the individual residents. There should also be, these next two kind of fit together, a behavior support plan and medical management to maximize health. And these go together for people living with dementia. It's difficult for them to communicate oftentimes, and they will have they will act out with behaviors that can be difficult to manage. But if you spend time and really look at and understanding what the underlying cause of that behavior is, you might be able to manage that and really provide a high quality of life. Unfortunately, a lot of times what happens is somebody's behavior, they may be acting aggressively or compulsively, and the easy reaction oftentimes is, let's provide medication to manage that behavior. So that's why I say that behavior management and medical support really fit together in an important way. There are times when antipsychotic medications may be indicated to help someone and improve their quality of life, but we want to make sure that we have behavior management in concert with that medical management. And then the last area that we talked about a bit is physical environment. And I think the standards that are outlined in the assisted living license will interplay with this. But for people living with dementia, floor patterns, I'm looking at the carpet here, it's actually a pretty good floor pattern here. It's solid. It's not confusing. People can have problems with balance. So really regulating that physical environment with the needs of people living with dementia in mind is another area that we thought should be touched on. So that is a quick summary of the work that we have, and I'd be happy to meet with any of you individually to go through that in more detail. I'd also be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Ms. McMullen, and thank you for all of that work. And I like how you laid it out in here. It was easy. Thank you so much. Next up, we are going to have Amanda Vikstrom and Sean Burke from the Minnesota Elder Justice with the Electronic Monitoring Work Group. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. Good morning. My name is Amanda Vikstrom. I'm the executive director at the Minnesota Elder Justice Center, and this is Sean Burke, our public policy director. The Minnesota Elder Justice Center is a statewide nonprofit organization, and we work with victims of abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation, older and vulnerable victims of abuse, neglect, financial exploitation. We do provide those direct services to victims, and 1 in 10 older adults will be victims at some point during their life with a cognitive impairment. Their risk goes to 1 in 5. We do work with victims who both experience that abuse in facilities, but also in their homes at the hands of family members and loved ones. So this is a very broader, more complex issue. We appreciate the opportunity to have convened this work group on electronic monitoring and to have been part of the conversation and hopefully part of the solutions of this issue for the past several years and going forward. We were asked by Commissioner Malcolm to convene this work group to explore areas specifically of consensus around electronic monitoring in residential care facilities and to really dig into some of the areas where there was disagreement. This issue, as you might remember, first came to surface during the 2016 legislative session. And at MDH and the legislature's request, we convened a prior work group that lasted for 6 months between July of 2016 and January of 2017. And during that time, much of the background work and research into what other states were doing and best practices and digging into the issue was really done and set the stage for this complex issue to move forward this past year. Electronic monitoring is an issue that we need to address with legislation because current law is silent on the specific issue. Many do view it as a right, that as it's not prohibited, but some facilities are now not allowing it. And so there is tension and confusion, and the residents and victims are getting kind of caught up between families and facilities and what is allowed and what's not. So on the surface, it seems like an easy issue, but you'll see from our report and what Sean will talk about, it's really a balance between privacy, safety, and autonomy. So in this work group, we wanted to provide an opportunity for all stakeholders to participate in finding consensus-driven solutions. And we did have broad participation from industry, from family members, from consumer advocates, DHS, MDH staff, to really dig in to how we could move this forward. And we built off the work that the legislation that had been introduced last session and work that had been done in 16. So we didn't start from kind of a new place. We took that work that we'd already done and brought it forward as possible solutions. We met 9 times between September through December with the goal of really reaching consensus on as many parts of electronic monitoring as possible. And I will say that all participants agreed from the beginning that that electronic monitoring in residential care facilities should be allowed. So we weren't discussing whether or not we should even have it. It was really how it should be done. So our goal was to determine how residents and or representatives in facilities can place a camera in their room. And Sean, I'll turn it over to Sean, and he will share highlights of the report that you should have received. We have copies in the back of the room in the talk about the many areas of consensus where that the work group reached. There do remain a couple of issues where there's just disagreement on how to approach this. And so the report does note the different options and tries to reflect the integrity of the group and where there was disagreement and why. So I'll turn it over to Sean.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sean Burke, Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Elder Justice Center. This work group was a little different than the other five, mainly because we were already working on some legislative language. And so what we really did in those series of meetings is went through essentially 15 topics and subtopics. And what the report reflects is extensive conversations, at least two deep dive conversations on all of these topics. There's a summary of the topic. There's also sample language, sometimes more than one set of sample language to reflect some of the policy differences, and then some comments about why the group chose some language over other language. Briefly, I want to kind of highlight some of these topics because it's one of those issues that really gets complex as soon as you dive deep into it, and other state laws reflect that. So, for example, a definition of a monitoring device. Really, not one state has the same definition. There's several different definitions. What we decided to do was systematically approach this, and that the definition needed to do three things. It needed to state what the device was, it needed to describe its broadcast recording ability, and then it needed to state what was the purpose of the device. And the reason we did this is we were trying to kind of solve the balance between having a broad enough definition to encompass different types of technology, emerging types of technology, but also narrow enough so that anytime someone walks into a room with a cell phone, is that automatically a monitoring device? And so the complexities that presented is why we took some time and then developed sample language, careful sample language around that. We did not reach consensus on all 15 topics, but for many of them, we had general consensus. This was not a formal work group, so we were not voting on language. But when we say general consensus, that means most members, most of the time when they were there, agreed that this was a good idea. Potentially, other issues might arise that a particular stakeholder didn't notice or wasn't involved with. But for the most part, when we say general consensus, there is broad agreement. There is some of those areas of general consensus include the definition of the monitoring device, a definition of a resident representative, which is really important because most of the situations in which monitoring happens in long-term care facilities doesn't necessarily generate from the resident themselves. It's usually a loved one or a guardian who is worried about the care being delivered and worried because the resident themselves may not have the cognitive capacity to protect themselves. So defining the universe of who the resident representative is was important, and we came to some general consensus around that. The issue of consent and how that person obtains consent is important, and then the contents of a notification form. A few areas of disagreement still remain. I think one of the largest is once a notification form is signed by a resident representative, does that resident representative have to give the form to the facility? This is a difficult question because as a lot of consumer advocates and family members will say, that might seem like a simple act, but the idea of putting a camera in because you're worried about your loved one raises fears of retaliation. And the relationship may already be at a point that it is dysfunctional. So some advocates say no notification. Others say there should be notification. And we did spend a little bit of time seeing is there a compromise position. Should there be notification generally, but are there situations in which a resident for a limited amount of time can monitor without that notification because of the fear of retaliation? That is outlined in the report, and I suspect will be a big part of our conversations around this topic going forward. Reasonable accommodation is another area where there are some differences, although I don't think things that are too far apart that can't be worked out. So we can stand for questions, and we expect to continue with this work throughout the session. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burke and Ms. Vikstrom. Members, we are hearing the electronic monitoring bill next week in this committee, so I think maybe we can hash through some of those questions then. Senator Ralph, I'm going to hold you because we've got to keep moving. Go ahead.
One very quick question, and that goes to the resident representative. That issue is much broader than just cameras, and I wanted to express my thought is that we can't look at that one just in isolation. And I'm assuming that was taken into consideration in your deliberation, so I'm looking forward to seeing what you had to say about it.
Thank you, Senator Ralph. Thank you, and thanks for coming. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we've got the State Ombudsman, Cheryl Hennin, to talk about the Consumer Rights Subcommittee. Welcome, Ms. Hennin.
Good morning. Thank you very much for this opportunity to come before you today. And I want you to think about every time something comes up related to elder abuse or related to committee work, we all need to be asking the question each time you review legislation, if resident rights have been thoroughly considered. Resident rights cross over every topic. So I appreciate, first of all, and thank you so much for your attention to working together to making things happen this session. But to Senator Rolfe's comment, we cannot look at these things in isolation. We must be crossing over and asking those important questions. So to my right is Aisha Elmquist, and she is a rather new member to our office. She joins me because she did such great work in getting us to where we are today. But we also must not minimize the value of the stakeholders involved in this work. I was so grateful. We met four times, and the variety, the representation in the room was just phenomenal. The commitment, great. So again, I know that people are working on proposed legislation. We have to. That is part of our job. But when you do that, I just ask that you consider all of the work of many people. There are many of them in the room today. And you have heard from me in some individual meetings that we have some real kind of muscle behind the recommendations that you will hear. So again, as I said, we had a wide variety of people that joined us. And so in a very short period of time, so imagine this, you're not used to all being in the same room at the same time. So that ability to come to consensus was just so incredibly valuable. So I will point out for you areas of consensus, but then give you a taste of the other topics that we talked about, which you will hear again and again. So it goes back to things crossing over and not being in isolation. But I appreciate the attention to the fact that we're all here together to improve the quality of life for people that receive long-term care services and reside in our long-term care facilities. So the three these are consensus areas. We identified three important focus areas, including strengthening rights, enforcement of rights, and education about rights. So let me just give you quickly, what did we talk about in strengthening of rights? So I have to tell you, I was incredibly grateful and humbled that across the board, every time we met practically, there was support for increasing staff in the Ombudsman Office for Long-Term Care. Many of you know what we do. We're advocates. We're independent consumer advocates that are at the bedside, at the side of people receiving services, and the law allows us authority to do that. So I didn't walk around campaigning, please tell people we need more funds. It came naturally out of our work and out of our discussions, and I really do appreciate that. And why is that? Because the fundamental work of the ombudsman is to empower people in understanding their resident rights and to also be working to strengthen and improve resident rights. Enforcement of rights, you've heard some of this before, but it was also discussed at length within my committee. There needs to be consistent enforcement of home care statutes in assisted living. And we're concerned of the fact that the health department is not able to meet the statutory requirement of licensing settings, assisted living, every 3 years. And so in that discussion, we talk about the health department having the adequate resources available in order to meet that statutory requirement of surveys. We talked about increased fines for certain violations. And we talked about, and this is something that's very important to consider, is the relationship between rights and duties is important when looking at statutory language. There is a need to make sure that responsibilities for compliance and enforcement are clear in law. So an example, if you look at the nursing home federal resident rights, there is implicit language in there that there is a duty of the provider to enforce. That's not in the Home Care Bill of Rights, in statute, in all the different areas. We talked about that. I was incredibly inspired by that discussion because it points out a very valuable piece that I'm sure the industry, the provider industry, may be talking about as well. Education of rights. And as I mentioned earlier, the Ombudsman's Office is involved in doing that. But and again, in the nursing home, federal resident rights, it's somewhat quite clear, and it should be delivered at the point of admission what the rights are. In home care, you have many different, there's a set of home care rights. This is very cumbersome and can be very complicated for people who receive home care. So we talked about the fact, and the Department of Health, the industry, others were involved in at one time combining the Home Care Bill of Rights into one comprehensive Bill of Rights. And we really talked about how that should happen again. Of course, if we see a change in the regulatory framework, that may be something very much a positive to work on. Consumer rights issues, consensus. Again, you'll see the additional funding for our office. Unanswered calls for help, improper medication administration, discharge, transfer, eviction without proper notice, lack of respect for residents, unsafe buildings or equipment. These are the kinds of complaints that come to our attention. And so we talked about the value of more of us out there in the settings. We spent, and I also will add that an important part of preventing rights violations and protecting consumer rights, that upstream, the prevention is what you're talking about. What are we doing about what we know is happening here in order to prevent it and minimize it? That's something we can provide some assistance with. Retaliation. Prohibition against retaliation. Retaliation can be in the form of an adverse action against a resident if, for example, the person files a complaint. Retaliation, we spent a lot of time talking about retaliation. We have agreement on prohibition, our consensus against retaliation. The areas that we talked about and the value of time, we may have been able to move that consensus needle a little bit more. We talked about individual enforcement of retaliation through private right of action. We talked about a clear definition of retaliation in the Home Care Bill of Rights, including a rebuttable presumption. There is not a clear definition of retaliation in the Home Care Bill of Rights. We need to identify and really define what it is and enforce the prohibition. So it's starting at the beginning. What is retaliation? And have that definition and then work towards how we would adequately enforce it. Multiple participants agree there are inadequate protections against retaliation in assisted living. In terms of enforcement, again, the value of time, and you will hear aspects of enforcement through my colleagues and their other committees. We did spend time talking about admission, transfer, discharge, better enforcement of the Home Care Bill of Rights. And again, we spend time talking about fines and penalties. To continue, and this is very important, we had consensus on resident and family councils in assisted living settings. And there is, to me, that is so very, very important because it allows for a constructive feedback loop between residents, families, and facility staff in assisted livings. So our consensus revolved around residents should have the ability or freedom to organize and participate in resident groups and these in assisted living settings, and that the provider would provide a space. We start where we know we can all agree, and the fact that we should have councils or to be able to support them, and then that there would be a space provided, we have very good support on that. Additional protections, numerous times lease and service terminations were discussed as needing to be improved. And you know in the commissioner's presentation this morning, it did come up. When we talk about areas of concern, for example, from the ombudsman's office, we all know in the memory care units especially, the population is quite vulnerable, with little protections related to discharge. So, for example, if a person is receiving home care services and the service is to be terminated, there may be only a 10-day notice of termination, and that's it. There is no right to appeal. So we want to look for what is necessary in due process related to persons who are living in assisted living settings. We talked about that during our meetings. I think it's important that we also look at the improved disclosures. People are very interested in more transparency. What am I paying for? And if my bill changes, why did it change? And was I notified in ample time in order to make some adjustments? There needs to be improved transparency as well in the fee structure with nursing homes. Many times we have consumers asking us, I don't understand what I am paying for. I would love to understand it in more of a detailed manner. So working towards more transparency in that area is important as well. I also feel that we must also consider what is working well. We don't want to over-regulate. We don't want to miss the steps of what are we doing that is actually working well. And so we spent time talking about that. And something that came up is there are a number of assisted living housing with services that actually do have resident councils. And what could we learn from that? So we also know that many people are supporting person-centered practices, and we need to ensure that this is something that's consistent across all locations. Higher quality of life is certainly obtained or has a much more better opportunity of being obtained when we look at supporting person-centered practices. So I have submitted a final report, and I really do appreciate and want to thank all of the participants in these committees for the four meetings and for the countless hours that people took looking through language and giving us input. And I sincerely thank the members of this committee for continuing to move forward with us and make some great positive changes in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you so much, Ms. Hennen. I want to apologize to the next two presenters. If you could keep it super brief, because I can only be in this room till 10:15. So if you could each do it in 5 minutes, and then we can call you back. So come on up, Marie Dotseth, Department of Health on Quality and Safety in Long-Term Care Settings. I'm so sorry, Ms. Dotseth.
Oh, no problem. I'll go fast, and I look forward to coming back and talking to you, any questions you have. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for letting me come and talk about our work today. I really appreciate it. I want to also thank our working group who stuck with us and really discussed a number of really important topic areas. I also wanted to appreciate the line of inquiry from the commissioner this morning, talking about a number of the things that this group has talked about. You know, what does the regulatory system amount to? What have we learned through all of this work? And we are addressing some of that through this working group as well. So I also want to mention that the work of this group is envisioned in addition to the regulatory improvements of the other groups, so not separate from, but in addition to. So it's a whole entire package. It's complicated work. We really appreciate the opportunity to work with the stakeholders on this. Just a quick note on process. That in addition to the working group meetings that we all had, we also convened committee of the whole in between this, realizing that people had a lot of places to be and tried to split up their time. So all of the working groups met collectively, periodically, in between the working group meetings so that we could kind of cross-populate and share and understand themes that we were all dealing with. For example, the workforce shortage issues. It was really helpful for the groups to meet and talk about that. Together. So you can see the work we did. We looked at some vision, values that we could all agree to, developed a charter for to guide our work on an ongoing basis. You can read the bullets on what we think our ideal system would be. I would just say that it might be what you would expect, but we spent a lot of time in our group talking about the ability to learn from what we had and use our data, accountability for results, and transparency. So you'll see that as a theme of our work. On the barrier side of things, I will just point out three uniquely, because you had already talked about this morning, that we noted that our regulatory system doesn't necessarily enable a learning culture, and we need to have a strong regulatory system and find ways to enable that learning culture. We have some interesting definitions, and I think the commissioner mentioned some. You know, when we talk about substantiated, unsubstantiated, and inconclusive, that terminology doesn't help us with the full breadth of quality improvement activity that we need to do. So we need to look at, you know, there are legal definitions for some reasons, but we need to continue to use the full breadth of data that we get through a variety of sources to be able to improve. And then finally, that last bullet there, we are challenged by and want to make sure we pay attention to and include to the extent possible frontline staff and actual residents in the work that we have going forward. So I will just say that many of the work groups envisioned kind of right now as a deadline for their work in order to turn over a product to you for your consideration. I think all along our group knew that our process would be ongoing, and so we are developing a charter for ourselves to continue our work into the near future. We talked about a number of general topics so far. We are looking to identify some specific work that we would have moving forward, and you'll see there some of it includes data availability and use, including the MDH data that we have through our regulatory process, tools that would enhance and improve reporting, and advancing a culture of safety. These are some of the potential projects that we intend to hone in on. I should note that one of the things we wanted to do is look at the work that we could do collectively. We all know that a number of us are doing important work individually on our own, but there is a benefit sometimes for us to do something collectively, and the types of projects that you see here are some of what we identified as potential work for collective action. So That was really quick, and I just appreciate the chance to share a little bit here with you today.
Thank you, Ms. Dassett. I appreciate that you went so quickly. Thank you so much. And thanks for all your work in the off session, too.
Thank you.
A lot of work that you guys did, so thank you. Carrie Benson, Department of Human Services and Board of Aging. Welcome. You've got the Assisted Living Report Card Working Group.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. And I will also go very quickly through the work of this group. The work of this group really builds on quite a long history at DHS, starting in the nursing home area, now in assisted living, in developing an approach that we refer to sometimes as our kind of variation on a three-legged stool to really encourage, support, and reward quality, high-quality services by our providers in the long-term services and support system. The three components of this type of approach include a valid measurement system. So this is the development of a system to have valid and reliable measures about quality of services and quality of life for people who receive long-term services and supports. Public reporting, which involves sharing of information about providers, about the quality of the services that they provide, the quality of life of individuals receiving those services, and making that available to inform purchasing decisions on the part of older adults, their family members, but then also the Department of Human Services. That's where we get into the value-based purchasing, where we are undertaking an effort now to understand how we could incorporate value-based purchasing into more of our long-term services and supports programs to reward quality of services and quality of life of service recipients. So again, as I said, we have a long history of work in this area in the nursing home arena, and we want to learn from this and replicate it as we can for assisted living and then into other areas of home and community-based services. The Assisted Living Report Card Work Group met one time, and I'll go into more detail in terms of why that is, but we identified very quickly strong areas of consensus for this area of work. There's definitely consensus that a report card is needed as a component of encouraging and rewarding quality of assisted living providers, that as Commissioner Malcolm often says, we can't regulate ourselves out of the situation that we're in now, the reality that we have, and that we want to also support provider efforts to provide high-quality services, and we want to reward those as well. The nursing home report card, because there's such a history in this area for the nursing homes, it's really benefiting from a lot of existing data. It has those three legs of the stool in place and well underway, and we really lack that to a large degree in assisted living. And so we have a long ways to go, but we want to get started. And developing an assisted living report card then will take time, and it definitely needs to be coordinated then with the work of the other groups, in particular the assisted living licensure and the dementia care standards, but really all components when we're looking at how to and what do we mean by quality in assisted living. And we had very strong consensus about the need to bring front and center the voice of older adults who reside in assisted living and their family members in terms of quality of life as perceived by the older adult, satisfaction of services as perceived by the family, and together that being a very strong component of a report card going forward. We're already taking steps to begin the development of an assisted living report card, and that is why we had just that one meeting so far of the work group. We were able to, at about the same time, start a contract with the University of Minnesota to help us work through a systematic, deliberate process to identify quality domains for assisted living, and then subsequently we will delve into the measures themselves. What we will do is go through the work activities listed on the slide in front of you, And throughout that process, we will work with the University of Minnesota to provide our work group and the broader range of stakeholders that have been involved with these work groups overall opportunities to provide input. We'll make sure they know where we're at in the process and they can be involved in that as they're able to and interested in. At the end of that process, we are going to engage a technical expert panel, again, similar to what we did with the nursing home report card development. That will happen this summer. And then subsequent steps after that are areas where we would need additional resources to be able to continue this work. And we wanted to be sure we were clear about that in particular the surveys of older adults and family members, we don't currently have the resources for, but I wanted to be sure that you were aware that the work group felt very strongly about the need to bring that forward as a part of a report card effort. And then we would also need to go about the process of and hopefully continuing our partnership with the University of Minnesota and all of the work that they've done on our nursing home report card, but do go through that development process of defining the measures, developing the measures, and then, of course, making those available on a report card public-facing website. And with that, I will end there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much, Ms. Benson, and for all of the work that you did, too. Thank you, and we look forward to working with you this session.
Thank you. I do,
right.
Too.
Thank you. And we will be meeting next week, same time, same place, for the electronic monitoring bill. We are adjourned.